Hello, is the intercall operator there? David, do you know the number to get them back on? Yes, is the intercall operator there?
Yes, sir.
Yes, are we back in conference?
You are back in conference.
Very good. All right. We are ready to start the afternoon activities here. We have Dr. McCusker at the witness table, and Ms. Babcock will question for the respondent. Please go ahead, Ms. Babcock. Dr. McCusker, could you first raise your right hand for me? Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give us will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Please go ahead, Ms. Babcock.
I'll start by saying we do have a short PowerPoint. I'm not sure what trials it we're up to, but...
Do we have copies?
Being handed out as
okay,
we speak.
Great. I think this will be Respondents Exhibit 16, according to my count.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Could you please state your name for the record?
Christine McCusker.
And what is your profession?
I'm a pediatric immunologist.
And could you briefly describe your collegiate and medical education?
I have a BSc in microbiology and immunology from the University of Toronto. I have a master's degree in molecular virology from McMaster University. I have 3 years of a PhD thesis degree in immunogenetics, also from McMaster. I have my MD degree from McMaster University. I then went on to do a residency in pediatrics, clinical fellowship in allergy and clinical immunology, and then 2 years of a postdoctoral research fellowship in immunology at the Meekins Christie at McGill University.
And are you board certified?
I am board certified in pediatrics, in the American Boards of Pediatrics. I have a Royal College certification, the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada certification in pediatrics and allergy and immunology, as well as the Collège des Médecins du Québec certification for pediatrics and allergy and immunology. So those would be the Canadian equivalent of the American boards.
And are you an examiner for any licensing boards?
I'm an examiner for the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada for the exams and qualifying exams for allergy and clinical immunology.
And do you hold teaching positions at McGill?
Yes, I'm an assistant professor at McGill University, and I have teaching responsibilities that extend from teaching basic undergraduate immunology courses, teaching medical student immunology courses, as well as teaching both postgraduate, grad student courses and resident courses in immunology.
And do you hold laboratory positions as well?
Yes, I have both a clinical laboratory responsibility and a research laboratory responsibility. Mm-hmm. I'm a principal investigator of a research laboratory at the Meekins Christie Laboratories of McGill University, where my research interests are in understanding or studying the developmental immune system from infancy through to essentially adolescence, and trying to understand how the immune system sets itself up and is regulated throughout that period of time, particularly early in life. And my clinical laboratory responsibilities, I'm the clinical director of the immunology laboratory at the Montreal Children's Hospital. where I'm responsible for the organization running quality assurance of clinical immunological testing, as well as with two of my colleagues with the signing and interpretation of lab results, which will then be sent out to the ordering physicians.
And is that immunology lab also a national reference center?
Yes. Our laboratory runs tests that are specific for the diagnosis of primary immunodeficiency, and in that capacity we have developed and have accredited certain immunological testing for the diagnosis of specific humoral immunodeficiencies. As well, we are the reference center for several different provinces in Canada, including Quebec, Nova Scotia, and the other maritime provinces.
Now, what is the division between your research and clinical work?
I'm officially 50% research and 50% clinical.
And about how much of the latter is clinical lab?
Approximately, of that 50%, it would be, sort of, we called that 100%, be about 30% of my clinical time is spent in running and managing the clinical lab.
About how many patients do you see in a month?
Somewhere in the order of 200 on an average month.
And are the majority of these adults or children?
There are almost exclusively children. I rarely see adults.
And do you see children in a general pediatric capacity as well?
Yes. My clinical time is, in actual seeing of patients, is divided into a clinic a week where we see patients with who are being evaluated for primary immunodeficiency, a clinic where we see patients who are being evaluated for allergies and allergic problems, and then I do a what's called a walk-in clinic or a drop-in clinic for minor pediatric emergencies once a week. And then I do two to three emergency room shifts a month, where I am often in charge of the emergency room at Montreal Children's Hospital. In that capacity, I can see anything from very minor problems to acute resuscitations, patients who require significant medical attention.
And have you published in the field of pediatric immunology?
Yes, I have.
And about how many times, or how many times have you testified in a legal proceeding?
This will be my third time.
Now, in the course of your current practice, as you just described, do you see children who have recently received an MMR vaccine?
Yes.
Is fever a common occurrence after MMR?
I wouldn't say that fever is a common occurrence. Fever does occur.
Even a high fever?
More rarely, but it certainly can occur.
And does fever typically have long-term clinical ramifications?
In the context of MMR, not in my experience.
Now, moving back to pediatric immunology, I wanted to start by taking a historical look at what was theorized about autism and immunity. When you discussed Dr. Gupta's evaluation in your report, you mentioned there was a time when autism was thought to be related to immune dysfunction. What was the genesis of this theory?
That theory was initially put forth by an investigator by the name of Stubb, who started looking at immune responses in children with autism, and he initially started with a case report and then a case series to determine whether or not some of the effects that you were seeing in autism were related to the immune system. Since that time, there have been several studies that have tried to evaluate immunity in autism, and up until the present time, the studies have been somewhat inconsistent in their findings.
So would you say that, and let me be clear, Stubb was published in...
The first publication was in 76.
In the 70s. Would you say that that theory is generally, or that hypothesis is generally accepted today?
Yeah.
Now, getting back to Dr. Gupta's report, I want to go through it in some details. It's obviously been a topic of conversation. Generally, when making conclusions about immune function, is a single evaluation sufficient?
As a general rule, no. The immune system is not a static organ. It doesn't stay the same throughout your entire life. It changes as you age, it changes as you develop, it changes with the environment that you're exposed to at any given time and on any given day. So as a general rule in our practice, when we're evaluating patients for primary immunodeficiency, and we see several patients a week who come to us for that problem, we will start with an initial screen of the immune system, and any abnormalities that are detected are always followed with a repeated test to see if it's consistent over time.
Now, can you talk in general about how these evaluations are done?
Yeah, sure. When we're asked to evaluate a child's immune system, basically we have to use the tools that we have at hand. It would be nice to be able to be thorough and complete, but we are not able in the clinical laboratory to fully evaluate a child's immune system as you would in an ideal world. What we have at our disposal is the capability to examine essentially the adaptive immune response. We have some specialized testing for children who appear to have problems with the innate immune response, but for the most part our focus is on the adaptive immune response. So essentially what we're looking at is the T cells and the B cells, and we want to know, do those B cells, are they present? Do they look normal as one would expect, and do they function normally? So in order to do that, we have to look in two ways. One, we look at their numbers, and we do that by a method known as flow cytometry, where we take the lymphocytes of a patient and we run them through the flow cytometer, and we look to see how many lymphocytes they have, what is the distribution of the lymphocytes, the T cells, the B cells, the different T cell subsets. We can do B cell subsets now, as well as the NK cells. And then we move on to look at the functioning of the immune system. So the functioning gives us, we have two options for that, to look at the Th1 arm, or the cell-mediated arm of the immune system. Primarily what we can do is we can look at whether or not the cells can activate in the presence of a stimulus that's appropriate. So we take the cells, we put them in a petri dish, and we try to stimulate them, and we look to see if they stimulate. In order to look at the other side of the immune system, at the other arm, the humoral arm, we look to see if the T cells and the B cells were able to communicate, because if they were able to communicate, then the B cells were able to be told to produce an antibody. So if you have antibodies to stimuli that you know the child has had, then you know that that arm of the immune system is intact. So we can do that as our initial screen. And then if we find an abnormality, we will generally begin to do finer and finer testing, all the way to genetic testing to determine where the problem is.
Now, evaluating a child's immune system, is it important to use age-specific values?
Absolutely. There is absolutely no question.
Is the immune system of a child the same as an immune system of an adult?
No, it is not.
Slide 2 here also is from Dr. Ward's report yesterday.
Basically, what you can see in this slide is that the numbers of immune cells, these are just absolute values, change significantly over time. And that unless you are going to specifically examine the patient at the age-appropriate time, you really don't have any idea of what is normal and abnormal.
Now, in her expert report and testimony last week, Dr. Byers stated that it is standard practice to use adult values to assess a child's immune system. Do you agree?
I do not.
And to be clear, do you evaluate immune results like these on a regular basis?
Yes.
And when you test in your own lab, do you use age adjustment measurements?
Yes, we do.
And is this practice widely accepted in the pediatric immunology community?
Yes, it is. It's considered standard of care.
Now, although Dr. Byers made this assertion, she also used normal values from several of your filed papers in her PowerPoint presentation. Did you review these slides in her testimony about them?
Yes, I did.
Do you agree with the ranges that she proposed?
She put the adult ranges on her slides.
She put the adult ranges?
Yes.
Okay. Now, she seemed to make a point in her slides about stating that the values you used were from foreign laboratories. Is this correct? This is slide 3.
Go on to slide 3. What you can see in slide 3 and what the blue arrows are highlighting are the values that are reported in my report for the TMB cell enumerations and their normal ranges. This report comes from the study of Shearer et al., which is also filed. I'm not sure what
Respondents Exhibit C at tab 4.
And Shearer et al. Is a large study in the United States which looked at 807 children to define the normal ranges based on age. And this particular study, three of the participating centers were from California, including UCSF.
Now, would a pediatric immunologist at the University of California, Irvine, use different normal pediatric values than a pediatric immunologist in Montreal, Quebec? Does it matter that Michelle's testing was done in 1997 and you have the benefit of more recent normal values?
It really does not. This is slide 4. What slide 4 shows you is the normal pediatric ranges that were available as of 1992. They are the ranges that actually we still use as our initial screen today, although we tend to move on to the Shearer paper for the finite testing. And the reason is that in this particular study of Hannon et al., they had a relatively small number of patients per group. And the Shearer paper had a much larger patient population from which to draw so that they were able to achieve more accurate ranges. And again, this moves back to the concept of the pediatric immune system. Because it can vary from day to day, the more patients that you have of that age group, the more you're able to capture what is a normal range on a normal everyday variance. So that the Shearer is probably more accurate based on numbers, but this is what was available in 1992, and it really isn't significantly different from Shearer. I just chose the more accurate numbers. And when you're talking about this particular analysis, what you're using, as I mentioned before, is a flow cytometer. So the question is, was flow cytometry in 1997 significantly different from flow cytometry in 2007 or 2003 when Shearer did the work? And there have been changes and upgrades to the machines. Certainly they work much faster than they did in 1997, but the principles are identical. And because most of these studies, or all of the studies, and all of the work is done in accredited labs, they have to maintain a certain consistency in their results, particularly for these kind of studies, because they have vast-reaching effects, not just for the diagnosis of immunodeficiency, but these results are used for the diagnosis of cancers, they're used for the diagnosis of problems post-transplant, they're used for many different reasons in medicine. So it isn't just to evaluate immune systems because immunologists like to do that. Really has much broader, broad-reaching effects. Nephrologists use it, hematologists use it, oncologists use it. So I thought I'd take a second and just kind of explain what flow cytometry is so that you can understand where the consistency is. Basically, a flow cytometer is a machine where you take a patient's sample and you drop by drop through the machine. And the drops have been treated in such a way that you ensure that only a single cell from the patient passes through the reader at any given time. So it's a very thin drop that drops down from the retainer, drops through past the reader. Now what is the reader? It's actually a laser. So when the cell drops into the reader, the laser hits it. And that laser hitting it causes the laser to scatter. That scattering gives us a lot of information. It tells us the size of the cell, and it tells us how much stuff is inside the cell, the granularity of the cell. Using that information alone, we can differentiate the different populations of white blood cells. We can say that granular cells tend to be things like neutrophils, macrophages, those kind of cells. The less granular cells, they're smaller and less granular, those are the lymphocytes. So you can then gate, it's called gating, where you circle that lymphocyte population and you can study it further. So how do you study, how do I say that how many lymphocytes in there are T cells? Well, T cells are defined on this, on the, they're differentiated from one another on the basis of certain surface markers. And flow cytometry takes advantage of that, and there have been antibodies that have been made in the laboratory to these specific surface markers. So there's an anti-CD3 antibody, there's an anti-CD4 antibody, there's an anti-CD8 antibody, anti-CD19, CD20 antibody, and there's lots and lots of different ones. And in fact, the one of the things that has improved in the last 10 years is that this, the capability to type cells has expanded dramatically by flow cytometry. But using the antibodies that were available in 1997, these antibodies are then coated with a tag. The cells are put in the presence of these antibodies, and any cells, for example, that are CD4, this is an anti-CD4 antibody, will bind it. So that when it passes through the reader and it gets hit by the light, it will glow a different color. So it will change color, and it will glow, for example, depending on the tag you use, it'll glow green. The receiver actually can detect, oh, that's a cell that scattered this way, so is a lymphocyte, and glowed green, and as such is a CD4 positive T cell. So it's very simple in that sense. The concept of a flow cytometer is really simple. It's beautiful technology. But it hasn't significantly changed. They've gotten faster. The antibodies may have gotten a little bit easier to use. But the reality is, if there's a tag on the antibody, that antibody has that receptor and therefore is counted as a CD4.
So, is it fair to say it's still your opinion that the values you used in your report are the values that should have been applied to machine used immunological evaluation?
Yes.
Now, let's move on to Dr. Gupta's actual testing. What were the serum immunoglobulin and antibody response results?
Okay. So, in terms of her immune workup, the serum immunoglobulin levels, that is the IgM, IgG, IgA, and IgE total levels, were all within normal limits. In addition, she made antibodies to the components of the vaccine she had received, including diphtheria, tetanus, rubella, polio, pneumococcus. And finally, with respect to the measles virus, she had detectable measles IgG antibody, but no detectable IgM antibody, which would be interpreted as being a child who has seen and cleared measles virus.
Now there's the next slide. I wanted to talk about testing for T and B cell enumerations. What were the findings?
Well, I think it's clear from my slide here that essentially if you apply the normal ranges that are appropriate for a three-year-old child, her T and B cell enumerations all fall within the normal range.
Now, this chart has something called percents and absolute numbers. What's the distinction?
When you're looking at the flow cytometer, basically what the flow cytometer captures is a certain number of cells that run past the reader, run past the laser. If you call the total number of cells that are red 100%, and then you calculate, or the machine calculates, how many of those glowed green, then you know that her CD4 count was 38%. But that gives you a percentage. It doesn't actually tell you what an absolute number is. And in order to convert that to an absolute number, you need to know how many cells were in the pool to start with. So you need to have an evaluation of a total lymphocyte count. And then once you have an evaluation of the total lymphocyte count, what you do is you calculate, well, 38%, and there was 150,000 cells in the lymphocyte pool, therefore this is the total lymphocyte count that is represented by the CD4 count. Now, why is that important? Well, to use only percentages can sometimes run you into trouble, because if a patient has an extremely low level of lymphocytes, is lymphopenic, which happens under certain conditions, then your relative percentages become less valid, and you really need the absolute number in order to determine where the decrease in the T cell or the B cell population is occurring.
And in particular, can I draw your attention to CD4, CD8?
Yeah.
Is that value normal?
It is for me.
Now, what are proliferation studies? Next, slide 6.
Proliferation studies are a little bit more variable from laboratory to laboratory. And these can be much more difficult to interpret. And in fact, you really have to be very careful when you're interpreting proliferation studies. The reason is that unlike the flow cytometry, where basically if the cell's present, it's going to glow and you're going to see it, and so your error range is fairly narrow. There's error that can occur, but it's fairly narrow. They're called in vitro studies, where basically you're doing something to the sample and asking for a response. The problem with biological assay systems such as this is that there are many places in the assay to introduce error. So, for example, what is a proliferation? We take the patient's lymphocytes, we put them in a petri dish, and we put in that petri dish with some growth factors and media to keep the cells happy, we put a factor that will stimulate the cells. And what you see on this slide are the factors, the mitogens, which are phytohemagglutinin, concanavalinin, pokeweed mitogen. Why do we use those? Because they are known to activate T cells and B cells in some instances to divide. If you have an extremely sick B cell or T cell, even under this aggressive stimulus, it will not divide. So an absence of T cell proliferation is important diagnostically for when you're diagnosing SCID, when you're looking at post bone marrow transplant and you want to see if any of those cells are healthy in a patient population, SCID being severe combined immunodeficiency.
Thank you.
Sorry. but basically, how do you know that the cells are dividing? Well, what you do is you put into the culture media a marker. And some people, we use tritium, tritiated thymidine, which is incorporated into the cell when it divides, and then the cell will glow in a reader. Which seems relatively simple, but lot-to-lot differences in the thymidine can make a big difference in your absolute values that you see in when you're looking at the results. So, for example, in our laboratory, and it's standard for the pediatric laboratories that I have encountered, we always control patients on the same day with a known normal control. Why? Because that means if the tech sneezed into the dish, doesn't happen. But let's say it could. Or if the temperature of the room was too high, or the carbon dioxide content of the incubator was too low, the cells are not going to be as happy. And these are very fragile cells in culture. And so if they're not happy, they're not going to proliferate as efficiently. Well, if your test case doesn't proliferate efficiently, then you're left with a question. Is it because it just didn't proliferate efficiently and there's a primary problem? Or is it because the tritium wasn't as robust as the last lot? And the only way that you're going to know that is if you control it with a normal control. Now, unfortunately, for the case of Michelle Cedillo, I was not provided with a control value that was run on the same day. It's not available in the transcripts. So it is.
I'm sorry, by transcripts you mean it's not available in the medical records?
Medical records, sorry.
Okay.
It is any interpretation that you want to make on the proliferation studies, you really have to put into that interpretation the codicil that you are not sure what the sensitivity of the assay on that day was. Having said that, I did find in the Stern paper, which is the Stern 2005 paper, which one that is?
Filed. We filed it with her report.
Yes. I did find normal ranges, or at least ranges, because in that paper they compared autistic children proliferation assays to normal controls run on the same day. And so, if you look at that paper, you can see that's what is presented here as the autistic children's range and the normal children's range. But really, you know, and if you look at those ranges, then the results of Michelle Cedillo fall within the normal range.
Just to be clear, it's Exhibit C at tab 7.
What is it? Sorry.
Exhibit C. It's my fault, not yours.
So, so essentially, given the results that I have available to me, it would appear to me that her T cells were able to be stimulated, her T and B cells were able to be stimulated up to a reasonable level in this assay. But again, it's qualified by several different methodological issues.
Now, you alluded to this earlier. When would proliferation studies cause you concern in a child?
We are particularly worried about proliferation assays when they are severely depressed, when you do not get proliferation much above the background levels.
And these tests from Michelle Cedillo?
They are considerably robust. I mean, I suppose I could imagine that her unstimulated, which unfortunately is not given, might be somewhat in the higher range, but even if you put it in the higher range, you would say that those were perfectly acceptable responses to the mitogens, because they proliferated well.
Now, moving on to the immunoglobulin subclasses, what were Michelle's test results?
Her subclasses?
Mm-hmm.
She had normal for range IgG1, IgG3, and IgG4. Her IgG2 was mildly elevated compared to normal ranges.
Now, what is the clinical significance of a mild IgG2 elevation?
There has not been any defined clinical significance in the extant literature for humans of an elevated IgG2. There is some case reports or case series that suggest that specific IgG2 antibodies can be elevated in periodontal disease.
Now, are you aware of any literature where they looked at autistic children in IgG2 levels?
Yes, there was the paper by Trav... it's always a hard name for me.
I think it's
Trajkovsky et al., 2004.
See, it's tab 11.
Where they looked at immunoglobulin subclass levels in patients with autism compared with their neurologically normal siblings, and found that there were changes in IgG1 and IgG4 levels, but no changes in IgG2 levels. So it's really difficult to know what the significance of that is. And in fact, these kind of studies haven't been replicated, so it's also very hard to know what they mean in general.
Overall, what conclusions can you reach based on the immune evaluation of Michelle Cedillo?
Well, as I said in my report, in my opinion, I would evaluate this child if this was the lab reports and that I was to sign out as an entire normal immune response.
And even though he may have used adult values, did Dr. Gupta come to a similar conclusion?
Yes, he did.
So would you agree or disagree with Dr. Byers' conclusion regarding Michelle Sedillo's immune evaluation?
I disagree with it.
Now, moving on to the subject of Th1, Th2 skewing. It's obviously been discussed by several experts in reports and testimony. I wanted to start by talking about the background of this principle. When was the theory developed? This is slide 7.
The first report of cloning of Th1 and Th2 cells was in 1986 by Mossman et al. And in that study, what they were able to do was they were able to stimulate T cells in culture and clone out, meaning find T cell populations that they were able to isolate away from the other T cells that would produce either the cytokine interferon gamma or the cytokine IL-4. And because they were able to clone these two cytokines away from each other and find these populations of T cells that would only secrete one or the other of these cytokines, they called one Th1 and the other Th2. And since they had known up until that time that interferon gamma was important for activation of macrophages, was important for the driving of a cell-mediated immune response, the Th1 side of the immune response was considered to be cell-mediated. Because IL-4 was important in the activation of B cells and therefore the formation of antibodies, they separated the two into Th1, Th2 being the humoral arm of the immune system. Now, although this paradigm has been very useful in helping us try to understand immunoregulation, it has subsequently been found to have several flaws. And the first of the main flaws in this particular paradigm is that when these things were first defined, they were defined in mice, and they were defined in inbred mice. And the inbred mouse has a much simpler, in quotation marks, type of immune system. You can study it under several different immune threats and look to see what happens. And it seems to separate much more directly into Th1 or Th2 than what the human studies were showing. And so probably about 5 or 6 years ago, maybe a little longer, about 1999, people started to think, well, that paradigm where it's Th1 or Th2 and the two don't crosstalk, and if you have Th1, Th2 goes down, if you have Th2, Th1 goes down, seem to be too facile for at least in the human population. And there were studies that began to look at what the immune system did, in fact. And believe it or not, rather than simplifying things just got more complicated because, like everything in immunology, if you find an effect, you define a cell. So they defined a new cell type, and they called it the T regulatory cell type. And since there has been extensive amount of active research on T regulatory cells and dendritic cell T regulatory cell interactions, and in fact, that's one of the things that my lab does at the Meekins Christie. So I have a lot to say about it, but I won't. T helper cell subsets have now been. This is probably a little bit out of order now. Sorry. Have now been defined as Th1, Th2, T regulatory cells. There's a Th3 cell that has been defined, and there's now a Th17 cell that has been defined. Th17, not because it would have been easier to call it Th4, but because the cytokine that defines it is called IL-17. So they decided to just follow the interleukin instead of calling it Th4 to bring it down the pathway. I know it just adds confusion, but immunologists are crazy. Nice, but crazy.
And is this the illustration of what?
So this is the illustration of what we currently understand is the choices that a naive T cell has to make once it sees its antigen.
Now we have slide 10.
Yeah. Okay.
We're going to go back to 8 and 9.
Okay.
I jumped ahead. I got excited.
So So it's safe to say our TH1 and TH2 are mutually exclusive based on our current understanding.
Yeah. And in fact, there have been many studies now that suggest that once antigen T-cell interactions occur, yes, an individual naive T-cell makes a decision and it will go towards one of these pathways. But there are many different clones that are being activated at any given time. And that those T-cell, dendritic cell or T-cell antigen presenting cell interactions are unique to the T-cell, dendritic cell, and they don't pay attention to what their neighbors are doing. And so it is clear that both TH1, TH2, and T-regulatory responses occur in concert. Now, as the immune response progresses, one tends to predominate, the one that is probably considered to be most necessary for removing the threat, but all of them occur. And as the immune response begins to wane, as the body begins to combat the infection and the antigen level drops, in fact, low antigen levels promote the formation of T regulatory cells. So that basically when you have a high threat, you're going to go for your effector cells, which are your TH1 or your TH2, because they're the ones that are going to be able to activate the cytotoxic cells. Toxic, that's a good cell to get when you're infected with a virus. They're the ones that are going to be able to activate your B cells in the TH2 arm to produce antibodies so that you can combat the bacteria and the extracellular pathogens. But as that threat is coming down, you really want to be able to turn that response down. So as antigen level drops, the regulatory cells start to increase. And those cells are responsible for just calming down the response and shutting everything off.
How is TH2, we can go back to slide 8 here.
Yes.
How is TH2 cytokine-induced antibody characterized in humans?
Well, TH2 is characterized by the initial production of IL-4 and then the subsequent production of IL-13, IL-5, among other cytokines that have been shown important. What the importance of this slide is to show you that, in fact, if you are driving towards TH2 with This is with a significant amount of cytokines, so that you would consider this to be a TH2 predominant response, then the type of immunoglobulins that you're going to see are IgG1, IgG3, IgG4, and IgE production. And this is taken from a study in humans. The animal data, the different subclasses vary slightly in mice, but this is what is found in humans in a TH2 response.
And were these values measured in the Shell Cidio?
Yes, they were.
And what were the results?
They were all normal.
And I believe slide 9 is just the summary there. Now, what happens with respect to TH1 and TH2 when a vaccine enters the immune system? Now we're skipping to slide 11.
Sorry. I realize that this is a bit of a complicated slide, but it sort of talks about the things that I've already mentioned. In the center, the orangey cell there, that's the naive T cell. So that's the cell that once it sees its antigen has to make a decision. And it sees its antigen, and the decision that is made is dependent upon the antigen-presenting cell, so these guys here that are depicted in green, and the T cell itself, and what's happening in the environment. So if there is a dendritic cell, for example, who has seen an antigen that it considers to be a threat, now how does a dendritic cell know that? Because there are these innate set receptors found on the antigen-presenting cells that have been called PAMPs or toll-like receptors, and these receptors, the certain repeating structures that are found on viruses and bacteria that make them viruses and bacteria, not mammalian, not human, so that the immune system says, wait a minute, this doesn't come from me. They can bind into these receptors and they can tell the dendritic cell, you have picked up something that is dangerous. It's sort of the danger theory of immunity. And that dendritic cell will process that antigen presents it to the T cell. But at the same time as it presents it to the T cell, it expresses other receptors. And chief among these receptors, I probably won't get into it, but basically these receptors talk to the T cell at the same time as the T cell sees the antigen. And they say, you know, when I've seen this danger signal before, or when evolutionarily, when this danger signal came, this one really needs a Th1 response. So why don't you start producing a lot of interferon gamma and activate the Th1 cells? On the other side, let's say it's a bacterial cell wall product, lipopolysaccharide being a classic example of that, that will bind into its toll-like receptor, TLR4, and the dendritic cell will be induced, or the macrophage will be induced by the TLR4 engagement of the receptor to tell the T cell, you know what, this is an extracellular pathogen. It's okay if, you know, some T cells want to make cell-mediated responses, but our focus should really be making of antibodies, because that's what's going to protect us. I mean, that's how we now think that the innate system is able to help mold and craft an immune response that is appropriate for the antigen, for the invading organism, to protect us from it. Can I ask you a question?
More or less.
More or less.
Clear up. It's a clear up talk. Now, Dr. Byers asserts that Michelle had evidence of a dysregulated immune system at the time of her MMR vaccine. Do you agree?
No.
And did she also state that the presence of the fever was a sign of immune dysregulation in Michelle Cedillo?
Yes, she does state that.
Did Michelle have any evidence of immune suppression at the time of her immune testing in 1997?
No, she did not.
Now, Dr. Byers cited to a paper by Agrawal to postulate that thimerosal is affecting the dendritic cells.
That's correct.
And did you read that paper?
Yes, I have.
What was the immunologic effect on the dendritic cells that Agrawal observed?
When he treated the dendritic cells, the human dendritic cells, with thimerosal in the presence of the stimulus LPS, he found that there was downregulation, decreased production of the cytokines TNF-alpha, IL-6, and IL-12 component P70. He also found an upregulation of IL-13 and IL-5.
So downregulation of IL-6.
That's correct.
And just a small point of clarification, I think Dr. Byers said that dendritic cells secrete LPS.
Yeah, she did. I'm thinking she may have made a mistake, because LPS is found in bacterial cell walls, and so dendritic cells do not secrete it.
Now, what is one of the major effects of IL-6?
Well, IL-6 was first defined along with IL-1 as a component of a substance that, way back in the early days of immunology, was known as endogenous pyrogen, because it is one of the major cytokines involved in promotion of fever.
So if IL-6 is downregulated, would someone be able to produce a fever?
If IL-6 is downregulated, one would anticipate a blunted fever response.
Blunted?
Blunted. I can't tell you that it would be absolutely abrogated, because there is IL-1 still available, although IL-6 and IL-1 are intimately associated in their regulation, so you might also postulate that IL-1 would be downregulated, but based on what he showed, you would anticipate a blunted fever response.
And what do you mean by a blunted fever response? Less fever?
Less fever.
Okay.
Now, there's been a lot of discussion of cytokines. And this is probably a topic we could be here for hours on, and we will not. But could you just briefly describe the role of cytokines in the immune system?
Sure. Cytokines are small proteins that are released by different cells. The leukins, the interleukins, were originally defined as cytokines that were released by leukocytes, and they were primarily thought to be used to allow for communication from one leukocyte to another. And they can be divided. They can be divided into several different ways. One of the divisions that is commonly used is that they're divided into pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory cytokines. Another division is that they are divided into short-acting or those cytokines that act over very short distances and those cytokines that can act over longer distances. So they can be divided into several different categories, although there is a current move afoot to try and categorize them much better based on their structure and function, but that's still a few years away.
Another small point of clarification, is nitric oxide a cytokine?
No, it is not.
Now, which immune responses are cytokines involved in?
Cytokines are involved in all immune responses.
Do they play a role in any other systems?
Sure. Cytokines are used in the CNS system to allow for communication between leukocytes of the CNS and the glial cells, astrocytes, other cells of the CNS. They're great tools for communication. They're secreted by other cells, not just cells of the immune system. They're secreted by astrocytes. They're secreted by smooth muscle cells of the airways. They're secreted by epithelial cells of the airways. So we now know that they are used as communication tools by more than just the immune system, although there are some that are very specific for the immune system.
And do cytokines act locally or systemically?
Well, we would classify the vast majority of cytokines as acting over a very short distance, very much locally. And those are the ones that are primarily responsible for activation of one cell type by another cell type. Because essentially you want to regulate that activation very tightly. You want that T cell that has already recognized this antigen. I'm a T cell for poliovirus, I've seen poliovirus, and now I want to activate that B cell that recognizes poliovirus. I don't want to activate this B cell over here that recognizes cat, because that's not going to help me. So those cytokines act over very short distances. Some cytokines, the more pro-inflammatory, the cytokines that are responsible for turning up inflammation, those ones tend to act over a slightly longer distance. And why is that? Well, because if I get a cut on my arm, I have to call in cells from everywhere to fight that infection. I don't want to be relying on just the local area cells. I want to be calling them in from everywhere. So the only way I can do that is to create a gradient, to release my cytokine, and it can shoot out its signal over a longer distance so that the cells can be called in to the area that is at risk. The other cytokines that will act over longer distances are things like IL-1 and IL-6, because you want those to be acting on the hypothalamus, which is your fever center, because you want to turn up temperature. Why do you want to turn up temperature? Because microbes, bacteria, and viruses really don't like high temperatures. They don't replicate well at high temperatures. And so it will slow down the replication. If you have a fever, it slows down the replication and allows the immune system a little bit more time to rally the troops, get everybody to the right place, and eliminate the infection.
Now, Dr. Byers discussed some of the black box warnings for some of the cytokines. If you're administering cytokines therapeutically, what type of doses are we talking about?
You're talking about what would be considered supernormal doses. You're talking about high doses administered systemically. You're not talking about what would happen in a lymph node when IL-2 is released, for example, which would be small doses of IL-2 in a confined space.
So these are not levels that would be naturally produced by the body. Now, I wanted to also clarify some of the terminology that's been used. Does the pediatric immunology community recognize the term selective immune dysfunction?
I have never heard that term.
It also seems that Th2 is being used interchangeably with immunosuppression. Does that make sense?
No, it does not.
What is a clinical example of someone with Th2 skewing?
Classic example of Th2 skewing is 30% of our population, those people who have allergies. And so when you see a patient who sneezes in the middle of ragweed season, in the middle of tree season, that's a person whose immune system skewed a little bit too far to the Th2 side and produced the antibody known as IgE, which is the only available biomarker that's easily assessed in patients for this quote-unquote Th2 skewing.
Now, is there any clinical evidence that Michelle Cedillo had Th2 skewing?
No, there is not. Her IgE levels were normal.
Now, if someone were significantly immunosuppressed, what would you expect to see?
I would expect to see a significant increased frequency of recurrent infections.
Is there any evidence that Michelle Cedillo had an abnormal or an increased frequency of recurrent infections in the time before her MMR vaccine?
Nope.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's okay. Now, if the theory is that thimerosal had a sufficient immunosuppressive effect on an immune system as to allow the persistence of the measles virus, what would you expect to see clinically?
If the thimerosal was persistent, and if that effect was clinically relevant, then it should not just affect the ability of the body to fight measles. It should affect the ability of the body to fight infection. So if you can't fight infection, your infections are going to be more frequent, they're going to be more clinically apparent, and they're going to last longer.
Now, is there any evidence that Michelle had an abnormal number of infections after her MMR immunization? Now, can you think of an example where the immune system has been altered in some way, physiologically or otherwise, where you would see the effects of T-cell depression?
There are several examples, but one of the ones that comes to my mind and that we see frequently in the immunodeficiency clinic is the disease known as DiGeorge syndrome. What DiGeorge syndrome is it's a genetic disease. And because of a deletion on chromosome 22, the way the body forms one of the major organs of the immune system, the thymus, is aberrant. But because of when this gene deletion, gene mutation takes effect during the development of the fetus, you can have a wide spectrum of clinical disease. So you have these children who were born, and they are born with what's known as congenitally athymic. They do not have a thymus at all. And those children are unable to mature T cells. So they have zero, no T cells, and they present very early in life as severe combined immunodeficiency. And without intervention, either bone marrow or thymic transplant, they will die very early. But then the vast majority, that's actually relatively rare, but the vast majority of children with DiGeorge syndrome actually have a spectrum of immunodeficiency, because although the thymus doesn't form completely normally, it does form. And what we have found from studying patients with DiGeorge is that the T cells do not form as quickly or as robustly as in a child who has a perfectly normal thymus. So their T cell numbers, when you look at them, when you do those T and B cell enumerations, they tend to have low T cell numbers because their thymus cannot handle the processing of the T cells appropriately. In addition, when you do your proliferations, they tend to have slightly decreased prolifs compared to normal. You would say, I would look at those prolifs and I would say slightly depressed T-cell proliferations to mitogens, consider congenital thymic dysplasia, meaning consider DiGeorge in your diagnosis. When they have looked at studies, now DiGeorge genetically has been elucidated relatively recently from a medical point of view in the last 10 years. So there have been many, many patients who have had DiGeorge syndrome who were not defined. And there are other congenital effects associated with DiGeorge. It's not just the thymus that can be problematic. So there are lots of children who, because of the other problems we've identified or suspected as having DiGeorge syndrome, that never came to our clinic. And these children received their full vaccinations. Interestingly, there has not been a reported case of persistent viral infection as a result of a live viral vaccination in a patient with DiGeorge. Now, our recommendations are, if we know a patient has DiGeorge, that we wait until we're sure that their immune system can handle the vaccine before we give it. But there have been many, 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 many children, and there is actually a large international study going on right now trying to collect the numbers of these patients who have received their vaccinations and have had no untoward effect as a result of it, because it gives us a lot of information. It tells us that you, even with depressed T cell numbers and decreased proliferations, these children are able to cope with the vaccine strain and clear it. And they can do it with measles, mumps and rubella, and they can do it with the varicella vaccine.
So overall, based on your medical experience, your review of the medical records, testimony, literature, what is your opinion as to Michelle Cedillo's immune functioning?
In my opinion, Michelle Cedillo had a normal immune system at the age of 3.
And you hold this opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
Yes, I do.
No further questions.
Let me follow up on the last question before we have crossed. You said normal immune function at the age of 3.
That's correct.
What about earlier age?
There was no evidence of immune dysregulation, in my opinion, before the age of 3. But if you're asking me to evaluate her immune system, the only objective evaluation that I have was at age 3, which was normal. Clinically, she, in my opinion, did not have any evidence of immune abnormality prior to that.
So you said at the age of 3 because that's when Dr. Gupta did his workup.
That's correct.
But you're also saying that throughout the medical record you looked at, you didn't see any clinical evidence of immune dysfunction at any other time?
No, I did not.
All right. Any cross for this witness, Ms. Jim Kaplan?
Yes, I am.
And do you know Dr. Ward and Dr. Fonball?
Yes, I do.
And you work with them?
I've worked with, truthfully. I know who they are. Dr. Ward is an adult microbiologist, so I don't interact with him clinically. I know him professionally. And Dr. Fonball, I've had some interaction with when he did his study of the immune responses in autistic children, because it was done in my lab. It was done as a research study, but using the services of our lab. So I had some interaction in that sense, but other than that, no.
And was your name on that study?
Nope. No, it was not. Sorry.
But it was done in your lab.
It was done in my clinical lab. It was incepted and run by Dr. Fonbaum and Dr. Bruce Mazur, who is my colleague. But it was not my inception, so my name was not on the paper.
Okay, and do you know what Dr. Fonbaum's role in this study was?
I think Dr. Fonbaum will be testifying. You could ask him.
Okay, I shall do that. And Doctor, if you take a look at Respondent's Exhibit Z, which contains your opinion, under tab 7. Is this the study that you're referring to, the Stern study?
Yes.
And Dr. Fonbaum is listed on this, correct?
That's correct.
And this study was done in 2005?
It was published in 2005. Okay. It was actually done in patients who were accrued in the immunodeficiency clinic between 1996 and 1998. It says in the abstract.
Do you notice any conflict of interest declarations on this article?
Back.
Okay. Is that where you publish it?
I don't see any, no.
Okay, thank you. So, Doctor, you were speaking of Michelle's immune status, and we're looking primarily at Dr. Gupta's records, is that true?
That's correct.
And that would be Petitioner's Exhibit 3, correct?
Yes.
I would ask you to take a look at page 12.
Yes?
This is the lymphocytes subsets, is that true?
That's correct.
And there is an indication that the normal range is that for an adult, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And, Doctor, does it indicate that the ratio of CD4-CD8, which is the helper-suppressor ratio, is 2.24?
That's what it says, yes.
And the normal range for this laboratory?
For the adults in this laboratory?
Right, was 0.82 to 2.02.
That's correct.
Okay. And, Doctor, for the CD20s, which is the total B cell count, the percentage is supposed to be 20, Michelle's was 21%, correct?
That's correct.
An absolute number is 670?
Yes.
Yes. And the normal range for this laboratory was a high of 16.8% cells?
The normal range for the adults in this laboratory was 16.8 cells.
And that the high range for this laboratory for the absolute numbers was 411?
For the adults, yes.
Yes. And the last one would be for the CD3, CD16s. And is that within the normal range for the adults? I mean, would that be the normal range for this laboratory?
For the adults, yes, you're correct.
Okay. Now, if you go to page 13, Doctor.
Yes.
These lymphocyte transformation mitogens, do you see any abnormalities here for this laboratory?
Well, again, there is no standardization for normal ranges for lymphocyte proliferations. Nothing's accepted either by the council that accredits laboratories or by the WHO, and it is laboratory specific, and you must always control it with a control sample. So it's difficult to know the validity of that normal range.
Okay.
In addition, it appears, although again, it's difficult to evaluate appropriately, that there are differences between pediatrics and adults. I realize that a lot of adult doctors see children as little adults, but they're really not.
I tried to say that today.
They're very different.
According to this laboratory, though, do they have a normal range listed?
They do, but it's for their adults, so you can't really use it to evaluate. And I think, although, you know, I am not Dr. Gupta and I can't tell you what he was thinking, I would think that given that his opinion was that her immune system was, and I quote, essentially normal, if he felt that her ranges were outside the norm for pediatrics, he would have commented on it. And certainly that's what I would do in my laboratory, and I assume he is as credible a physician.
And Doctor, the question before you was, are there normal ranges listed for this laboratory?
Yes, there are.
And for ConA and pokeweed mitogen, are they within the normal range?
Not for the adult normal range. No, they are not.
Okay. And Doctor, let's go to page 14. These are the lymphocyte transformation antigens, am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
For the mumps virus, is Michelle's range within the normal range for this laboratory?
For the adults? No.
And for C. albicans, is it within the normal range for this laboratory?
Again, it is not in the normal range for the adults of this laboratory.
Okay. And for the PPD, is it within the normal range for this laboratory?
Nope, not for the adults.
But for the tetanus toxoid, is it?
The tetanus toxoid is within the normal range for the adults. I think you should, though, make a small note. The PPD, to my knowledge, Michelle Cedillo never received a BCG vaccination. Neither did she have tuberculosis. so one would not expect her to proliferate to PPD, regardless of what the normal range is. And it is quite normal in patients who have never been exposed to TB to have no proliferation under those circumstances or not above baseline. So again, that's part of the problem with trying to evaluate these patients based on quote-unquote normal ranges, because it does depend on what they have seen in their lives.
Doctor, I'm going to put up a slide. This is the one that was in Dr. Byers' presentation.
And it's, for the record, it was slide 6 of Dr. Byers, it looks like. Go ahead.
Okay. Doctor, as you can see, the UCI, which would be the UC Irvine Laboratory, is all in blue. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, you've indicated that it's not proper to use adult values for pediatric patients. Is that
correct?
Correct. Okay. And you actually cited in your report several authors, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
It's interesting, though, that she calls the Shearer report a foreign laboratory. Okay. It was not only American, but 3 of the labs were Californian.
I think she used that to mean that it's not UCI. That's to distinguish it from the laboratory that treated her.
Okay.
So, doctor, if you like to look at the articles that you submitted, that's mm-hmm. more than fine. For Hannett, the CD4s, CD8s, and the ratio CD4, CD8s is in green.
That's correct.
And that would be what you consider to be the normal range, correct?
That is what was available in 1992 for a normal range.
Okay. But for the CD20,
Sorry, 1 second.
Sure.
Do we have that article?
What article are you looking for, Doctor?
I have it here. It's the Hannett article.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to check what the numbers are here.
Count though, you went to Shearer.
Yes.
And for Shearer, you use the CD4, CD8, CD4s, and CD8 ratio, correct?
That's
along
correct.
With the CD20.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But then for Gasparoni, you had different values for CD4 and CD8, didn't you?
I didn't quote Gasparoni in the values.
Did you quote it in your question?
I used for my evaluation of the TMB cell enumeration the Shearer report for CD4, CD8, the CD19 that was available in the Shearer report.
Okay, so you're saying that the basis for the normal values is based in the Shearer report.
That's correct.
Okay.
And if you look at my slide, that comes from Shearer.
Okay.
I've highlighted it.
Okay. And if we just go to the T-cell function test, Doctor?
Sure.
Okay. Which is slide 7 from Dr. Byers' presentation. For the T-cell function test, you use Stern for the normal. Is that it?
That's the only one that provided a normal range. So, as I've explained, there's a significant problem with trying to find normal ranges, and most studies will not provide a normal range for proliferation assays. They will always compare to control. So it's you are limited by what is available in the
literature.
Literature. A little surprised that mumps was 1.3 when it's listed here as 1297.
So there's some errors here.
Or she.
Mumps was 1.2297.
Oh, she's
so she
just changed the units.
Yes.
Okay, sorry.
Yes. Okay.
But she didn't change the units for PPD. It's inconsistently changed, so that's, I guess, where my confusion comes.
You're right. And Doctor, just going to the next slide, which was slide 8. You had to go to Tretiakovsky to find the normal ranges for the immunoglobulin subclasses, correct?
Well, there are actually several different publications for normal ranges of immunoglobulin subclasses. In fact, what I was trying to look for was the most relevant articles, and because this article actually spoke about normals versus children with autism, I chose those normal ranges because it seemed to correlate with the population that we were trying to look at. But it doesn't, those normal ranges are not outside norms for age match controls. I used the Tretiakovsky's study because it did provide normal ranges and because it seemed to be reasonable to use that as a look to see whether or not it fit with even the autistic ranges.
Mm-hmm. And I'll note that Ms. Chin Kaplan referred to this as slide 8. It's slide 8 of Dr. Byers' presentation.
Yeah, Doctor, we did. If you go to page 15 of Petitioner's Exhibit 3, which was Dr. Gupta's record. If you look at this
which page, I'm sorry?
Sorry, 15.
Yep.
If you look at this lab result, is there an indication that for this lab, IgG2 and IgG4 were elevated?
Yes, there is an indication on this page.
Okay.
But these are not age-specific ranges.
Okay.
And again, particularly with immunoglobulin subclasses, their formation is developmental.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see changes in the development, the formation of subclasses based on age. So when I chose the Tretiakovsky's range, I was choosing based on age because it is given for age and age.
Okay. If you assume that these elevations are proper, are they of any significance to you at all?
Not really, in truth. It's really, I looked for, in the literature, for a clinically relevant disease associated with an elevation in IgG2 subclasses,
mm-hmm.
and was largely unable to find anything. I found an increase in IgG2 subclass-specific antibodies associated with certain infections, particularly, I mentioned before, the periodontal diseases, but I was unable to find a significant clinical relevance to IgG2 elevations. And with respect to IgG4, isolated IgG4, I haven't heard of anything that's associated clinically. Although it is elevated when allergic individuals when the IgE is elevated.
What about the combination of the two being elevated, IgG2
and
IgG4?
Well, I looked for that in the literature. I didn't really find anything in humans. Were you able to find something?
Well, have you seen anything that indicates that this would mean a skewing of the Th2?
Yeah. Not in humans.
Okay.
IgG2 is not associated in humans. It is in mice, but not in humans.
Okay. And Doctor, when we go to your report, Exhibit C, tab 11, page 748, that very last paragraph.
Oh, sorry, I have no more.
I sent to the literature.
Which page?
Page 748.
Okay, now which tab again?
11.
Okay, thank you.
It says increased serum concentration of IgGs in autism may point towards an underlying autoimmune disorder and or an enhanced susceptibility to infections resulting in chronic viral infections, whereas the IgG subclass skewing may reflect different cytokine-dependent influences on autoimmune B cells and their products. Have I read that correctly?
You have.
Do you agree with that?
No.
No?
I haven't found any evidence in the literature that would support that subclass changes are related to autoimmunity.
Okay. But this article says it.
This article postulates it.
The one that you cited in support of what your opinion?
The one that I cited to give you, yes, to give you normal ranges for age.
Now, Doctor, you said that you based your opinion primarily on the Scherer article that listed the different types of the different normative values for pediatrics.
Yes.
And Dr. Scherer is contained at Respondents Exhibit Z, tab 4. If we go to page 978, which is the discussion. If you go to the right-hand column with a sentence that begins, in addition, the range of coefficients for laboratory variables could be larger than the range of coefficients for age groups, indicating that the difference between the results of two different laboratories analyzing the same blood could be larger than the biggest difference between the age groups. Have I read that correctly?
That's correct, yeah.
So, Doctor, does that sentence indicate that you shouldn't compare one lab's values to another lab's values?
It's the recommendation that you stick to your own validated lab values. And what generally happens is in accredited laboratories, you're given reference samples, and the reference samples are given a certain value, and you ensure what your variance is over that reference sample. But the reference samples are based on the published ranges.
But they are recommending that you not use one lab value and compare it to another person's lab value.
They are recommending that you try and keep repeated assays within the same laboratory. That's what it says.
Okay.
Therefore, pediatric studies should use the same laboratory for following a patient's results.
Dr. McCusker, I just wanted to be clear because we've heard a couple of terms that have been used. Immune dysfunction, immune abnormality, immune deficient are all synonymous but distinguishable from immune suppression?
I would not use all three of those as synonymous.
Okay,
immune dysfunction. Immune dysfunction is one of those very nebulous terms that is used when you cannot make a definition of anything. You kind of say, there's a dysfunction. And sometimes that's used when you have a patient, for example, when we have a patient who's had multiple infections. Clearly, there is something that's not completely right with this child, but all of our immune parameters are normal. And essentially what we're finding now, as our technology gets better and better, that we are able to, in these kids, go back when a new immunodeficiency is defined and say, that's where the child's problem is. So
because we don't fully understand the way an immune, the all of the defects that are possible in children in terms of the functioning of their immune system, sometimes that word is used as kind of, I think there's something going on here, but I can't put my finger on it. Immune, what was the second one you used? Sorry.
Abnormality.
Immune abnormality would be used to define a objective laboratory abnormality.
Same with deficient, immune deficient.
Immune deficient would be used to bring together the objective laboratory abnormality with the clinical abnormality. So, for example, patient with a DeGeorge syndrome might be immune deficient because his T cell numbers are low, and clinically he may have more susceptibility to getting a couple more colds every year. He's not truly in danger, he's not worrisome, but there is something there in his immune system that is a little bit more profound than his friend down the block with DeGeorge syndrome, whose immune system functions perfectly normally. That they are used in slightly different ways to convey, I suppose, in a sense, the association between the clinical and the laboratory findings.
And each of those references is distinct from immunosuppression.
Immunosuppression, and classically, immunosuppression has been used when we use medications to suppress the immune system. That's often how it is used, at least clinically. So if I give a patient corticosteroids, I know I'm going to be immunosuppressing them because I know I will be interfering with the ability of their immune system to function normally. If I give one of the humanized monoclonal antibodies, those specifically knock out, are designed to knock out or interfere with the function of a specific area of the immune system. Those patients for that area will be immunodeficient or immunosuppressed.
Thank you. I did have one more question. When you talked about the DeGeorge kids, and you indicated that if you know that that you've got a DeGeorge kid, before you would administer an attenuated vaccine, you would wait to see how they handle colds,
well,
ear infections.
DeGeorge is it's a very interesting disease. But basically, children that do have thymuses, as opposed to the truly athymic DeGeorges, they're called complete DeGeorge, and they have no thymus, and they will never have T cells that function properly. Those that have either a vestigial thymus or a partially formed thymus or an immature thymus, they will be able to form T cells. But their ability to form T cells is delayed relative to their peers. And in truth, they never truly reach, the vast majority, not all, some do, reach normal level of T cell numbers. So their T and B cell numerations will always be slightly below normal. Because we don't know where on the spectrum an individual child is, are they sort of pretty close to complete DeGeorge but not quite there, or are they really, they have a normal, fully functioning thymus? Because we don't know that, because vaccines are things that you use to prevent disease, but because herd immunity will protect a given individual child, the risk versus benefits under those circumstances don't fall on vaccinating these kids, because we just don't know where on the spectrum they are. But things being what they are, many, many children with DeGeorge have been vaccinated. And we have immune parameters that tell us what their immune systems look like. And their immune systems are still depressed. And yet they are able to functionally combat and clear the live viral vaccines. So, you know, it's one of those things where if I know something to actively give a virus is, you know, not, I think, in the child's best interests. But if it's already been done, we can study it, we look at it, we say, wow, look, even with these low T cells and this depressed function, this child was able to clear this.
Thank
Let
you.
It happen again.
All right. I have a question for you, Dr. McCusker. Dr. Byers, in the slides that her slides that you just went over a few minutes ago with Ms. Chin Kaplan, her testimony was that because of great variances in laboratories, I'm summarizing her testimony to mean better to use the normal ranges from the UC Irvine laboratory, even though they included adults, than to use a pediatric range from some other laboratory.
Except that,
how do you respond to that?
Well, in truth, that would definitely not be considered, in my opinion, standard of care. It's not that they included adults, they are adult ranges. Adults' mm-hmm. immune systems are very different from children. And if you took a neonate, a newborn child, and you applied adult ranges, all neonates would have an abnormal immune system. That is clearly not the case. And in that situation, yes, there are some variations that can occur between laboratories. There are always ranges of error. But when you have, for example, as in the Shearer report, 807 children, you are able to get a decent range that is at least better than an adult range for a two-year-old, because they do not reflect the child's immune system at all.
So the in your opinion, the best would be a normal range, a normal range for children in the laboratory in question. That would be the best comparison if you had such a thing.
In truth, ideally, the best is an accredited laboratory that performs regular Q&A, and if their ranges do not match the ranges that are supplied by the accreditation service, whether in the U.S. it's the FDA, or in Canada we have our own laboratory accreditation services, if they don't match, you figure out what's wrong with your lab. But that's ideal. Ideal is that you have a lab where you can take that, you can take a blind sample, you can check it, and make sure that you're right. That's ideal. The next best thing, I guess, would be ranges for age from that laboratory. Although, in truth, when you look at 807 patients and you know what the ranges are, that's a very good indication of what is within normal. Because again, we're talking about small variations. We're not talking about this child having sky-high CD4s or unbelievably depressed CD8s. We're talking about a small variation, which, you know, in my mind, even at the best, would not be considered clinically relevant. However, ideal world, make your lab run properly, accredit it properly, and do the proper quality assurance to ensure that your ranges fit with what is published and what is acceptable. That doesn't work, then I guess you have to go about making your own ranges, but that would be more difficult because it's got to be population-based.
All right.
That raises a question for me. Let's assume for a moment that the normal values in Michelle's workups were children. Just assume that.
Mm-hmm.
Would, and Dr. Gupta is obviously an immunologist, or he's the director of the immunology laboratory mm-hmm. at UC Irvine. Would he have said, given then that many of her laboratory values are out of range, would he have said this? What he did, would a competent immunologist have said, oh, this is nothing to worry about, which is essentially, you quoted him directly, what essentially he said?
Let me just take one quick look at the ranges before I answer
okay.
that question, because I don't want to give you the wrong information. That would be tab 3.
And I'm sorry, I don't have his statement.
No,
right
I,
in front
I have
of
it
me.
Here. I have it here. It's the only reason I just want to look I mean, truthfully, when I looked at those values, given that I signed these things out all the time, I looked and said, oh, that's normal. And I didn't, you know, and then I went and started reading the reports and then had to figure out where the quote-unquote abnormalities were coming from. So my feeling is that if I saw these numbers, I would say this is a normal child's immune system, even given the ranges. And I would expect that anyone who's had any experience in quality assurance for flow cytometry would do the same. I don't know if that helps you.
Well, so it doesn't matter whether they applied the adult ranges or the child ranges in.
It's
in
always
the
a bad thing to apply the adult ranges.
Okay.
And I realize that there are variances between labs, but all of the labs use the published ranges. We all do quality assurance.
So if I understood what you just said, you're presuming that Dr. Gupta did what you did. Just look at the numbers and say, that looks normal, that looks normal, that looks normal, without ever looking over to the right for the adult range, because he already knew what the pediatric range was.
I mean, I can't speak for Dr. Gupta, but that's what I did.
All right.
I know that he has a robust clinical lab, so he probably signs these things out as regularly as I do, probably more regularly, bigger catchment area. So I was not surprised by his evaluation of her immune system. His conclusion, sorry.
Any redirect for this witness? Anything further based on our questions?
Just a few questions. Dr. McCusker, are you aware that Dr. Gupta has actually published an article about Th1 and Th2 cytokines and CD4 and CD8 T cells in autism?
I have a memory of that article, but I don't have it.
I'm going to refer you to Fujiyami, Respondents Exhibit R, Attachment 22.
Concludes, I mean, you have to realize this was done in 1998. So what they looked at in this study was they looked at the percentage of cells that were positive for IL-4, CD4 positive IL-4 cells, and the percentage of interferon gamma producing cells, and showed that there was a 6 seconds to scan a research article. Sorry. What they found was that there was more IL-4 producing cells compared with interferon gamma producing cells.
And IL-4 is a Th2?
IL-4 is a Th2 cytokine. Although they had a small population of 20 patients, and their p-value only just reached statistical significance. So you would actually probably suggest that this is more of a trend because it barely reached significance. Okay. This population. I just need to see one thing.